Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we will examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Joel Rogers, who is the director of the Center for Wisconsin Strategy, otherwise known as COWS, about what kind of strategy there is out there to counter what seems like a right-wing juggernaut sweeping the land with unlimited corporate riches, a corporate-friendly Supreme Court, and a political class more and more dependent on corporate largesse and billionaire backing. Then we will look into a massive land grab going on in Africa, where Chinese state enterprises and American hedge funds are competing to sew up as much agricultural land as possible for future food supplies that will not benefit the local inhabitants. Anuradha Mittal, the executive director of the Oakland Institute, joins us to discuss further the new report on this land grab that she has authored. Then we will be joined by Alistair Smith, the author of The Dictator's Handbook. He is a professor at New York University who has studied why dictatorships endure or fall, in the latter case because either the dictators are too new, decrepit, or bankrupt. We will apply his theory to the current rash of dictatorships facing their oppressed peoples. I'm now speaking with Joel Rogers, who is a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also directs the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, otherwise known as COWS. Joel Rogers has written widely on American politics and public policy and such books as On Democracy, Right Turn, The Forgotten Majority, What Workers Want, and most recently, American Society, How It Really Works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joel Rogers.
Nice to be here.
And let me just begin with my premise here that I was looking at Googling you on the computer, and of course, when your name comes up, there's the tirade from Glenn Beck and Andrew Breitbart and others who see you as this powerful manipulator of America, the ultimate puppeteer. But conversely, it seems to me that what's happening in this country now is what seems to be a kind of juggernaut that's sweeping the land with unlimited corporate riches, a corporate-friendly Supreme Court, and a political class more and more dependent on corporate largesse and billionaire backing. So which university are we in, the one that I perceive or the one that Glenn Beck perceives?
Well, to ask the question is to answer it. We're in your universe, Ian. We're squarely in your universe, not Glenn Beck's or Breitbart's.
So is this just the same old saw that conservatives used to define this mythical liberal power base, the liberal media, the idea that the liberals are in control when in fact the conservatives are in control, and as long as they can hoist this canard, they therefore move the goalpost further and further to the right?
Yeah. We have a quite conservative media in the U.S., and certainly there are mechanisms of media dissemination. When you look at the collapse of independent newspapers and other things, are quite poor. People in the U.S. have really low levels of understanding of the workings of their political system. And so it's very hard to say that the media has done a bang-up job informing people about much of anything. And it's certainly hard to make the case that the media is this wildly progressive thing. The contrary is more clearly the case. So, yeah, it's a big lie, and like all big lies, if you've got a lot of money behind it and you've got a lot of fear that you can stoke in the population, then, as we've known from many different unfortunate points in world history, including very prominent ones in the 20th, it's possible to manipulate the public pretty extensively. I would never, ever over, there's an old saying in American politics, don't ever overestimate the intelligence or information, or underestimate the wisdom of the American people. So I think people eventually, if they get the facts in front of them and if you talk to them long enough, get the point. And I think there's still something in Lincoln's old saw, right? There's patient confidence in the ultimate judgment of the people, ultimate justice of the people. But certainly democracy in the U.S. right now is in very bad shape, and the media is certainly not helping it much at all.
Well, I'm wondering, though, whether I've spoken a few times to George Lakoff, who believes that the left's biggest failure is its inability to frame things and use semantics as cleverly as the right does, and that they're dependent upon this 18th century notion of enlightenment, that if you only tell the people the truth, that shall set the people free. Now, the truth is a moving target. Karl Rove and others have proven that he who manages and manipulates the truth best wins, and that seems to be the world that we're in here now, where there is no national consensus on what is true. If a Sarah Palin can tell us that that Paul Revere was actually warning the British, not the Americans, in the Revolutionary War, and essentially get away with it, at least with her constituency, I'm wondering whether this is the inexorable effect of the diminishment and decline of public education in this country. In other words, the right wing are on a roll because people are getting stupider and less educated.
Well, yeah, a lot of my friends believe in an iron law of a declining rate of intelligence. And I'm still in the dispute with George. I'm still a sort of enlightenment guy. I mean, I know some of the cognitive psychology that, yeah, you can certainly manipulate people much more easily than you can win a reasoned argument. But once you've manipulated them one way, they can be manipulated another way. I still put my faith, and I think it's still supported by the available science, in some sort of reasoned deliberation. Then the question becomes, well, how could you possibly set up the conditions for that? Those aren't present in the U.S. And that goes into structural reform. There are a variety of things you could do to make that more likely. But I'm not a great fan of the idea of just framing things and, our frame beats their frame. There's stuff that we know in general about people, which has been true for a very long time. You need to have if you're going to have a strategy, you have to have some picture of the, as it were, the other side of the Jordan, right? The promised land. Where do you want to get? And the right's picture of the other side of the Jordan is pretty straightforward. It wants to end all social constraints on capital, and it wants everyone to be able to dispose of their property as they see fit. And then they have a program to begin to get there, and the sort of midpoint in the program is just reduce taxes and abolish government or get rid of government.
Well, but I think they've also successfully the United States is alone of all the advanced industrial societies where people in other societies where they have tremendous and deep social safety nets, they operate on the principle that you pay your taxes and you get your government services. Here, what seems to be happening inexorably is that the conservatives and the corporate powers and their political lackeys have come up with this wonderful system of diverting public money into private hands as opposed to recycling public money in terms of taxes coming back as services.
Right, and I think other countries are doing a better job in the actual provision of the services as well in many cases. I don't want to compare the efficiency with which we provide services in healthcare or education or transportation or other basic things that people, or energy, or other basic things that people need, to efficiencies that you see elsewhere, even under, more social democratic systems, more liberal market systems. I think there's a lot to the idea that government performance can be improved and should be improved, and I think simply saying, well, let's talk about the role of government in society and why you need public goods and that sort of stuff. I don't think that actually does a hell of a lot for you.
How then do you portray the promised land if you can't compare the low standard of living in the United States and the fact that people like the billionaire Warren Buffett say we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy and more the streets are looking third world and you're stepping over homeless people on the way to fancy restaurants.
Right. How do you, given that...
Yeah, what's the narrative that we put out there for people to recognize that there's a better way of doing business. I mean, the right wing have said big government's the problem. You would think that the counter that that would, it's not an argument about big government, it's about better government.
Yeah. I think our promised land is not a world in which you have the destruction of any sorts of social constraints on capital, but a world in which you have the institutions needed to support equal opportunity and security for everybody. I mean, that's my bottom line. I'm still into equal protection, equal opportunity, and say you substitute security for protection. I think you can make the case that you cannot get that simply through unregulated, untethered markets. You need to have some sorts of public institutions. Then you can say, okay, well, let's have those public institutions actually work, and fine. That's an argument that I'd be happy to engage and get the left in America off of simply defending government for the sake of government, because government for the sake of government is nothing. But the idea of having public institutions that are trying to generate equal or secure the conditions for real equal opportunity and security for everybody, I think that's an argument that we can win.
Again, I'm speaking with Joel Rogers, who's the professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the director of the Center for Wisconsin Strategy, known as COWS, and he's the co-author of American Society, How It Really Works. There are a couple of disturbing statistics, however. In 2008, 140 million people voted, and we know that Obama and the Democrats were swept in. In 2 years later, only 75 million, about half of that, voted. And it looks like the people that didn't show up the other side wins, the Republicans win with Democratic votes and with a low turnout. And that certainly happened. Now, this time around, it looks as though there's nothing inspiring the left who voted in 2008 to come back to the polls. And conversely, it looks like the Republicans at a state level are changing election laws to favor them and to restrict and restrain and prevent the vote of the Democratic base, along with redistricting and the unlimited money they have through Citizens United from the Supreme Court.
Right.
And their determination, to keep the economy in the doldrums with all this nonsense about deficit reduction, and instead of increasing revenues, they've sold the deficit hoax. So I guess I'm rambling here, but where's the good news, Joel?
The good news is pretty hard to find right now. I thought we were going to be talking about the changes that are going on in the states, but they are broadly of the effect that you're talking about. You now have 13 states, and it's going to be growing, that require different restrictive forms of voter ID or are in different ways increasing the difficulty of registering to vote in the first place, or are in different ways restricting the time during which you can vote. There's a lot of rollback of the early voting legislation that a lot of people attribute to some of the increased turnout in 2008, along with the substance of the campaign, of course, too. And then there's the decennial redistricting mishmash, which is basically aimed at making as few districts competitive as possible. So all that is very bad news. There's no question about it. I can't give you much solace here, Ian. I'm talking to you from Madison, Wisconsin, which is successfully described by a former Republican governor, 72 square miles surrounded by reality. But it is a state capital, and I think the sort of thing that we were doing from Valentine's Day on in reaction to a particular conservative, or not conservative, quite radical right governor here, Scott Walker, is the sort of thing that has to happen elsewhere. I do think that you can improve the conditions under which that sort of people's movement, or turning a moment into a movement, or whatever trope you want to do, can take hold. And I do think that in addition to yelling at ordinary people about their stupidity and their subject to their susceptibility to manipulation, I think a large part of the burden and the blame here goes back on progressives. When Lewis Powell wrote his famous memorandum in 1971, he said, look, there are very basic things that you got to do if you want to play politics. And if you really want power, you got to have the will to get it. And you have to have a basic set of institutions that are in place in order to play it. You need mechanisms of communication with your leadership and your own base and with the mass public. And they need to have lots of channels, and they've got to have lots and lots of content that's produced endlessly. You need to have mechanisms of bringing in young people to mentor and train and place them and take care of them, because that's how you feed yourself over time. You need to have a variety of hot shops of different sorts, service centers and other things that will enable you to do things in one place that you can't, it doesn't make sense economically to do in many. And then above all, you need a basic message, a bunch of trained messengers, and you need some models that you want to lift up, and you need some money. That's my reading of what Powell was saying. And when you look at the right over the last now 40 years, it has built that basic infrastructure, and the left basically has not.
And well, that, one thing I understand
is not, it's not just a function of corporate money. It's the fact that we have not wanted to do that.
Well, I think in many ways, it's the absence of a message that galvanizes a reality that's out there. And one of the most consistent realities that I'm being told of a lot by people I interview is that in spite of the Koch brothers' obvious success in getting the Tea Party to be their sort of useful idiots and getting this a lot of legislation, and they're behind a lot of this stuff at the state level to restrict the vote through a front group called ALEC that they fund. The long and the short of it is what I'm told all the time is that the American people actually do believe in the American dream, do believe in a middle class. They don't like the disparity of wealth. They're not entirely aware of how bad it is, but they don't like it. They don't like the idea that this country, the politicians are all in the pocket of the rich and powerful, and they don't like the idea this country could become an oligarchy if it's not already.
Right.
So who's going to put out the message that our very democracy is what's at stake, not an election?
Well, who's going to do it? That goes to the question of organization. You can wait for that to happen spontaneously, or you can build the structures under which it's going to be more likely to happen than not. And you can be a little bit more, strategic, at least forward-looking and anticipating the behavior of your rival. But unless you build that infrastructure, it's very difficult to imagine doing it at all. The right has the Koch brothers, and it has a million other people that are all reasonably well coordinated. I mean, they have their fractious fights all the time, you know, when to begin and end child caning, you know, how degraded should we make the public institutions precisely, how many more millions of people do we want to imprison in America, what are the costs of that, how many more countries do we want to invade, blah, blah, blah. But all that's within the frame of a common project of taking down a democracy. The democracy movement, and, you know, I'm all for making the issue democracy, building a more equal society or just a society fit to live in. People in general are not motivated by abstract ideals like that, although they sometimes are, but they cannot possibly come together and express their views with any confidence that their expression is going to lead to anything unless you have organization. I think most of the problems are organization.
Well, Joel Rogers, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
I'm sorry it hasn't been more upbeat, but what can I do?
Well, it's all right. It's all right. But, you know, people, remember, you have a, I don't know what your accent is.
Australian, right.
Australian, yeah. Okay. Well, remember that old expression from the diggers? The people lose every battle but the last. we haven't gotten to the last battle quite yet. We're getting closer. We're getting closer, no question about it. All right, nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Again, I've been speaking with Joel Rogers, who's professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the director of Chaos, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, and co-author of American Society, How It Really Works. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the land grab in Africa. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Anuradha Mittal, who is the Executive Director of the Oakland Institute. She established the Oakland Institute after working as co-director of Food First Initiative of Food and Development Policy. Her books include America Needs Human Rights and The Future of the Balance, Essays on Globalization and Resistance. The Oakland Institute recently released a new report detailing how hedge funds are grabbing up African land and working to destabilize global food supplies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anuradha Mittal.
Thank you.
And nice to be here. Thank you so much for joining us. And my understanding is that it's not just American and British hedge funds that are involved here. Also, the Chinese are making substantial investments in agricultural land in Africa. So is this my first sense of this is this may have something to do with global warming and the idea that the best agricultural land is in Africa, and this is how you're going to corner the market on future food supplies.
Well, a couple of things. You're right on. I think since 2008, when the world witnessed skyrocketing food prices, which was a combination of many things, including climate change, but also policies which are creating these opportunities for speculators to speculate in commodities, we have seen a rush towards land in poor developing countries, with most of it being in Africa. And there are three kind of investors that are moving in. The first two, actually, we have heard lots about. The first ones are rich but food insecure nations, you know, your Middle Eastern states, your Gulf states, that are going into countries such as Africa to be able to secure the food supply because they have the money, but they do not have the land, the resources. Second investors is countries such as India, whose corporations are going into places such as Ethiopia or China, who are not food insecure, but they might get food insecure. At the same time, they're looking at export opportunities. But the third trend that has not been talked about much by the media, and that's what we also focus on in this series of investigative reports that we released this past week, are that these private hedge funds, equity funds, who have nothing to do with agriculture, but see an opportunity after the collapse of the housing market and with the disappearance of the dot-com bubble, they have been looking for the next soft commodity to invest in, and they've found it, and that is agriculture. So lured by very cheap prices of land, lured by all kind of strategic investor statuses, such as not having to pay taxes, not having to pay profit taxes, the ability to export all your dollars out of the country, basically have complete water rights in these countries, control labor pool, they are rushing towards Africa for things that they could not get elsewhere. And that is what our reports reveal, and they should demonstrate that this is going to have very serious consequences for world's food supply, not to mention the serious devastation that such deals are causing for communities and families and farmers in Africa.
So I guess in a way, Anuradha Mittal, you could make the case that this is a sort of double whammy in a sense, because we know that speculators have been driving up the price of gasoline and food here in the United States and presumably abroad as well. And this has been the main problem why the recovery has slowed down. And this is what's hurting people most in the pocketbook. But on top of that, these same speculators are moving into Africa to make this killing on locking up the food supply of the future. And I guess the bottom line is their customers are not going to be in Africa, right?
Ian, that's a brilliant point you've just made. And I think that's, again, a unique thing that in our reports we have tried to put out. Because there has been talk about these speculators who have been profiteering through speculating on food prices, commodity prices, by speculating on oil prices. What we are also showing is that the same agents are now seeking control of land, water, resources on which this food is grown. But they're also going to control and dictate what is grown, how it is grown. So this is a kind of vertical integration of a food system that we have never seen before. So imagine your funds based in Portugal, in England, in the United States, in Dubai, controlling land in Africa, controlling what is grown on it, controlling the prices. And while they are kind of creating also this oil insecurity, by the way, energy insecurity, a lot of this very fertile agricultural land is being used to grow biofuels for exports to Western nations. And as you said, all this is to meet the needs of the West, while Africa is once again being colonized, its resources being used in any way they want with no kind of environmental regulations and assessments on the impact on downstream user or upstream user, and they are free to go.
So I take it then, Anuradha Mittal, again, the Executive Director of the Oakland Institute, the author of this new report on the great African land grab, I take it that the new nation yet to be formed, it'll be happening in July, is Southern Sudan, is oil rich, but the pipelines, of course, go through the north. That creates a problem for them. But my understanding is that there's an enormous amount of valuable agricultural land there, and that's where a lot of the investors are heading, right, Sudan?
Well, again, Ian, you said it. I mean, in this series of reports, we have released three very detailed country reports on Ethiopia, Mali, and Sierra Leone, but we've also released several briefs which look at specific land deals, and one of them is actually on South Sudan of a company out of Texas called Nile Trading and Development, which has several Texan connections, including to somebody who was appointed at U.S. Affairs.
So could you repeat that? I'm afraid, your phone dropped out, if you'd mind repeating what you just said.
Sure. I was saying that one of the briefs is about South Sudan. There's a deal that has been signed with a Nile Trading and Development Company, which is registered in Delaware. But we identified a lot of Texan connections in that deal. This deal is for 600,000 hectares of land with the ability to go up to 1 million hectares of land for only $27,000, basically. So it's a great deal which allows this company to clear the land and use any woods that are there. It allows the company to plant it with whatever they want, but it also allows the company to do mineral and oil exploration and gives them the right to sublease it to the third party. So basically, they're not just controlling the land, but also underneath what's there. It could be oil, mineral, whatever. And these kind of deals we are seeing in South Sudan, which involves such huge amounts of land, as I said, 1 million hectares of land for $27,000. And the communities don't even know about such deals. And very soon, this was the first phase of us releasing these investigative reports. But in the coming months, we will be releasing very detailed country reports, and South Sudan is one of them, where we document other such land deals, which also document U.S. involvement and point out what's so egregious about these deals.
So who are they making these deals with? Clearly, these deals are not benefiting the local people. Who do these foreign investors make their deals with?
Ian, it really varies in terms of who they're making the deal with. For instance, the deal that I just mentioned in South Sudan, that is made with representatives of of the local district offices. In case of Sierra Leone report, we point out where Quefel, private holding out of Portugal, it has, basically negotiated directly with the community, and you fool the local community who do not understand much of these things. They see a foreigner and they think of it as a civil society organization who has come to end their poverty, and they have no memorandum of understanding with the government. So each deal is kind of unique, and that's what we point we're trying to make, that there's such a lack of process and governance. If you look at, any extractive industry, thanks to the work that has been done by the civil society, they're all kind of procedures. But currently, when it comes to investment in land, the only direction has come from agencies such as the World Bank Group, which are advocating to these countries that become, friendly to foreign investors. That means get rid of your procedures, get rid of process. And in Africa, where because of colonial heritage, all traditional lands, all customary lands are considered, or communal lands are considered state lands. So it is very easy for a president or a president's advisor to get into a secret deal without providing all the information to the people whose lives are impacted and sell off the land. And people realize, which in my field work I realize, most times people realize that the land is gone when a bulldozer shows up.
So, Anuradha Mittal, yesterday in Zambia, in Lukasa, Lusaka, the capital of Zambia, the United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton warned Africa of a creeping new colonialism from foreign investors and governments interested in only in extracting the continent's natural resources to enrich themselves and not the African people. Was she obliquely referring to what we're talking about?
Well, definitely she was, and it was very exciting for us to hear Secretary of State warn the African leaders to watch out, that there's a new phase of colonization that is starting in Africa, where these foreign investors are seeking and rushing to Africa in this sort of a gold rush. We could compare it to land, you know, land rush can be compared to gold rush. And it was great. Unfortunately, she just talked about the Chinese who are rushing to Africa. As we point out in our research, and we look forward to, you know, informing U.S. administration better so they can educate their partners in Africa, that it is not just the Chinese or the Qataris or the Indians. Unfortunately, the Norwegians, the Swedish, as well as I said, private equity funds based in the Western world, they're all being driven to Africa, and they're promising their investors 25 to 40% returns. By the way, I might also mention that where our Secretary of State was speaking at AGOA conference, in the course of the research that we did involving private investors, we do know that some of these people who are colonizing Africa were sharing the platform with our Secretary of State, such as Susan Payne of Emergent Asset Management, Neil Crowder of Chaitin Africa. I mean, these are hedge funds whose goal in life is to profit and to, you know, reap benefits from poverty of Africa. I mean, just they talk about food security. We know, for instance, we have documentation that Chaitin Africa has an investment protection and promotion agreement with the government of Zambia, which allows it to export 80% of its produce outside the country. So while we talk about food security, this investor has gained this right from the government of Zambia that they can export most of the food, even if there are food shortages in Zambia.
Well, I'm afraid I'm sorry to interrupt you, Anuradha Mittal, but I regret to say we've run out of time. This is a fascinating subject. You've done us all a great service with this report. Can we revisit this conversation soon?
I sure do hope so, and in the meanwhile, I would urge the listeners to go check out this series of investigative reports. And as I said, all of this is done in secrecy, and we have released some of the documents that we collected in while doing this research, and we will be releasing more and more of these documents. So visit our website at oaklandinstitute.org or follow us on Facebook. Thank you.
Thank you again, Anuradha Mittal, who's the Executive Director of the Oakland Institute. And oaklandinstitute.org is her website. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Dictator's Handbook.